Welcome to Top 5, a show where we count things down from number 5 all the way to number 1. And this week, I looked in the archives. I could have swore that we've done this one before, but nowhere can I find in our RSS feed, the official feed of the Top 5 podcast, can I find that we have done the Top 5 movies of the 1950s. So we're going to do that this week, Rodrigo.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. I mean, eventually we're going to get them all. We got to do the 40s, the 30s, and the 20s still.
Oh, okay.
And then by the time we finish that up, we should be able to do one for the 2020s.
The 2020s.
Yeah. So that's, yeah, that's our next one, because we're all caught up to the 2010s.
Okay.
But so the next group will be the 2020s, which should be interesting. It, just like the 1950s. The 1950s was a year of huge explosion for cinema, both domestically and internationally, because internationally we were allowing in movies from Europe because of our censor boards, because of the Hays Code, because of the way that we had censors set up. The way to get around to tricky topics was to do it internationally and bring those in. Also, in many cases, the fact that we were bringing in international movies to the United States was a way of helping to rebuild post-war Europe and post-war Japan. We also had the rise of major epic movies in the 1950s because of television competing with the movie theater. So I'm very interested to hear what you have in your top five. And how about we begin with your number five?
Okay. My number five is a movie that I actually think about a lot. Like, I, you know, it's been around, obviously, since the 50s, but I forget about it. And then if something reminds me of it, I just think, man, that movie is, like, so stylish and a little bit funny and doesn't have much else going for it, but man, is it stylish. And I'm talking about Sleeping Beauty.
Oh, yeah. So I didn't put it on my list. It was something that I considered. I love Sleeping Beauty just from the design element alone. Just those backgrounds are so beautiful.
Sleeping Beauty is just there's a clear like design aspect that's not just like make characters that are like appealing.
Mm-hmm.
There's all of these like sort of like curvy sharp lines all over it, all over the characters, you know, kind of reminiscent of like medieval tapestry kind of stuff. Obviously the backgrounds by that point, the multi-pane technique was completely perfected, right? So everything looks really good. Now, does a lot happen in the movie? No. Is the structure of the movie super great? No, but it's definitely a feast for the eyes and ears, right? The songs are cute. And it just looks really excellent.
Yeah, that angled stuff in the animation is really fantastic. And I think the reason why Sleeping Beauty stands out is because it's post-Cinderella, so everybody is already into that Cinderella phase. But this was the last Disney animated movie that was hand-drawn before the studio switched over to the Xerox process with 101 Dalmatians. And there are just a few scenes in Sleeping Beauty where they use the Xerox process, but for the most part, it's still all traditional hand-drawn animation. And I think that may be one of the reasons why people like to gravitate towards Sleeping Beauty.
Yeah, it's art.
It is art. It really, really is. Good. I'm glad we're starting off on a good foot, Rodrigo, with your number five, because my number five is one that starts off with death. We start off with the body of Joe Gillis floating in a swimming pool. And he's like, yep, that's me. I bet you're wondering how I got to here. And so we do a flashback and we find out about Joe Gillis and him trying to get away from people he owes money to. And he stumbles upon this old rundown mansion that he thinks he can hide in. But lo and behold, it is owned and still lived in by an aging film actress from the silent era, played by Gloria Swanson. Of course, I'm talking about Sunset Boulevard and the somewhat I don't know if you qualify it as a dark comedy, but there are certainly bits that are a little bit insane as Joe Gillis, played by William Holden, tries to deal with the insanity that is Gloria Swanson in this role.
The movie starts with narrative from somebody who's already dead. So I'd say it qualifies as a dark comedy, certainly.
Yeah. Yeah. So the whole relationship between Norma and Joe Gillis is fascinating. It's beautifully shot. It's a Billy Wilder film. So, you know, in the 1950s, Billy Wilder stuff is somewhat unpredictable. Sometimes it could be a screwball comedy. Sometimes it could be a little bit more serious, but also that little hint of dark humor always in the background. So 1950s Sunset Boulevard makes my number five. What do you have for number four, Rodrigo?
My number four is possibly, it's a classic. It's something that is like immediately recognizable from the posters, from the any screenshots that you've seen of it. Absolutely legendary practical effects and costuming, Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Oh yeah, this is great. This is one of the horror movies.
54.
Yeah. Gotta love the Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Yeah, so the Gill Man, the Creature from the Black Lagoon, is to our eyes today doesn't look that great, right? But that's I think that's on like a very mild pass over it, because even right now, even for the time, there's some real artistry to the Gill Man, to like the way that it's made.
Mm-hmm.
Also made by a lady.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I believe the costume is designed by a woman, so yeah.
Yeah, so definitely, like, there have always been women behind the scenes in Hollywood doing excellent things, right? But we very rarely hear about them until much, much later. But yeah, Creature from the Black Lagoon, black and white, sci-fi, spooky monster movie, really created the archetype of the creature from the of that creature from nowhere, right? From like stories of cryptids. When you think about universal monsters,
yeah, you got your Draculas, your Wolfmans, your
Dracula, Wolfman,
Frankenstein,
Frankenstein. All of those come from either full-on novels like Frankenstein and Dracula, or folklore like the Wolfman. The Creature from the Black Lagoon just got invented for this, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
There's no, again, except for like some cryptids, there's no precedent for this. And I think it has become, when you think about those monsters, Creature from the Black Lagoon is there. The only one that's not there is the Invisible Man, because you don't know if he's there.
He's there. He's always there.
Yeah, he's just naked.
All right. Moving on to my number four, also a sci-fi movie. And what's interesting is when we say the name Leslie Nielsen, most people think of the comedies that he's been in later in his life. But in his early career, he was a leading man, a straight man, in many of his roles. And one of the roles that he is remembered for is a sci-fi classic, Forbidden Planet, from 1956. You've seen the poster with Robbie the Robot holding the passed out woman. It's got Walter Pidgeon and Annie Francis as this kind of very naive woman. It is a take on William Shakespeare's Tempest set in space. And it's got the worst monster imaginable in the whole movie, your own inner thoughts. It is a really cool kind of sci-fi. I mean, sci-fi movies have already been around for a while. People have gone to the moon, but this is the one that used, you know, really big special effects for the time. It used a lot of really cool rotoscoping stuff for the monsters from the id, and just really a cool look throughout the piece. And if you want to see Leslie Nielsen as the romance man, you know, the kind of the lead man in this thing, you definitely need to watch Forbidden Planet. It was shot in, I want to say it was shot in CinemaScope, and it was shot in, I forget what the, what color film it was, Eastman Color. And so the colors in this pop out. They're super saturated. And even though a lot of the sets are painted, a lot of the sets are matte paintings, you know, the set only goes as far as the back of the warehouse. It still feels like a rich world. And what better movie to have on your list of 1950s movies than Forbidden Planet from 1956. All right, we are quickly moving through our list, and we are up to our number three. So, Rodrigo, what do you have for your number three?
My number three, again, an absolute classic, a movie so well-regarded and so popular and so good that to this day we're doing riffs on it. We're just ripping it off wholesale. We are doing one overly long movie that's just the first 15 minutes of this movie. I'm talking about Seven Samurai.
Oh, yeah. Seven Samurai is also on my list.
Oh, nice. So, Seven Samurai, it's a Kurosawa film.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's got those wipes. Actually, I don't remember if this one has wipes or not, but it probably does. The story of a small town that is beset by bandits by grasshoppers or space Nazis. and they need to go out and hire some samurai. And Seven Samurai, I think, is like definitely one of those quintessential movies. Along with like Yojimbo, that sets up that Edo period feel, mm-hmm. right? It's mm-hmm. like the castle lords have fallen. There's all of these samurai that trained to be samurai, but now they have no one to serve, mm-hmm. so they're just kind of wandering the countryside as bodyguards, or they themselves become bandits or whatever. And it just like set that up so well that again, to this day, we're still doing Edo period stuff.
Yeah. Look at Shogun. It's really big on Hulu right now.
Yep,
so we're getting right in there.
Absolutely. Seven Samurai, an absolute classic.
Yeah, so when I talk about the rise of international films coming to the United States, I'm specifically speaking about Akira Kurosawa, because one of the ways that they were trying to rebuild the Japanese economy post-World War II is to encourage Japanese filmmakers like Kurosawa to make films that could then be exported out of Japan and into the rest of the world. And of course the U.S. government had limits on what types of film, like it shouldn't say the U.S. government, because technically it was the Japanese government doing it with heavy hands from the allies in the background. Mm-hmm. But basically it was, you know, things that were talking about the rich history of Japan rather than more of the recent issues that they've had to deal with. And so we do get this very classic movie, wonderfully rendered in black and white, that even today, I just watched this, I want to say a year ago, and man, it just still holds up, where you can watch this and go, this is just amazing work. This is the fight choreography is wonderful. I like that we, you know, literally have seven different characters who are each unique, not unlike the seven dwarfs, who are each unique in what yep. they bring to the table. And we get to, in this film that is, I forgot how long the film is. It's like, let's see if I can find it, 207 minutes with an intermission. So it's over 2 hours long. The fact that we get to know each of these seven characters and I, you know, identify and maybe feel empathy for each of these characters as they try to save this village and what they're willing to sacrifice in the name of honor and heroism, etc. It's really amazing that that is done. And then, you know, as you know, we wouldn't have A Bug's Life. We wouldn't have The Magnificent Seven. We wouldn't have that one episode of Star Wars. We wouldn't have all of these things, Star Wars, Clone Wars or Rebels? No,
The Mandalorian.
Oh, The Mandalorian did it too. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
So it's like, this is this story that you can retell again and again and again and again. And I don't think people get tired of the story, obviously, because we do keep making it and remaking it. But I think people don't look at the Seven Samurai in its original form. I think they know everything from the remakes, but I think that they would have a whole different experience if they went back to look at the Seven Samurai from Akira Kurosawa. And I think they would probably be like, holy cow. And there's probably even things that are in that movie that we haven't seen adapted in other forms yet, just because people are so focused on, here are these seven heroes or losers or whatever that you want to call them coming together to save the day. And so I dig that. So Seven Samurai ended up on number two on my list in this case. So.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. My number three, though, is so on my list, I have, your basic Hollywood movie in Sunset Boulevard. You have your sci-fi movie in Forbidden Planet. My number three gets into thriller territory. And during the 1950s and especially the 1960s, one of the best thriller filmmakers was Alfred Hitchcock. And of the Alfred Hitchcock library of films, my favorite is still 1954's Rear Window, which was remade years later as Body Double by Brian De Palma in the 1980s. The weird thing about, even though you look at James Stewart and you're like, oh yeah, James Stewart, everybody loves Jimmy Stewart. Everybody loves
It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah, everybody loves A Wonderful Life. Everybody loves Grace Kelly. And everybody loves, of course, Raymond Burr, all these things that people love about this film. And yet this movie is about a peeping Tom who sees something he shouldn't, or thinks he sees something he shouldn't. He's convinced that the neighbor across the street, across the courtyard, has murdered his wife and chopped her up into little pieces, of course, gruesome and grisly, and him slowly trying to piece together with the help of Grace Kelly and his maid, played by Thelma Ritter, as they try to figure out whether he did it or not. And Grace Kelly, of course, put in jeopardy at the end of the movie. So it really plays on a lot of taboo stuff that you didn't really talk about in the 1950s. Sex out of wedlock, the wild, crazy life of people in the city, peeping, you know, voyeurism, all these things that Alfred Hitchcock likes to play on. And I think he does it very, very well. And again, I put Rear Window as my favorite Alfred Hitchcock. And I know that there's other people who would say, what, not Psycho, not North by Northwest, not The Birds. There's something about this in the fact that you have one giant, massive set. Yet everything is kind of filmed in one. I mean, it's literally filmed in one location, even though everything is a giant set that I really kind of dig. So Rear Window was my number three. Rodrigo, what do you have in your number two slot?
In my number two slot, I have a movie that we talked about before, and I'm a little worried about talking about it.
Okay.
Because one of the times that we talked about it, the whole podcast had a meltdown and we lost it forever.
Oh, I know. I tempt fate every time I mention its name.
Yep. So, but
Beetlejuice.
Yeah, it would be terrible if I didn't put it out here, because it is one of my is like one of my favorite movies, period, not just from the 50s.
Yeah.
And that's Singing in the Rain.
Mm-hmm.
So, Singing in the Rain is a fun little musical movie. Boop 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 boop. Everybody enjoys it, but there's a lot to it. It's a movie about the advent of talkies in Hollywood. So it's a Hollywood movie about Hollywood, which people from Hollywood love.
Yep.
And it does something really smart and interesting, which is that it uses color to signify that explosion of sound, even though the movies back then were still in black and white.
Yeah.
So, we start in like very relatively muted tones, and there's this like huge number where like everybody's singing and everybody's dancing, and you're looking around and there are like ladies in like storefronts and they're wearing incredibly wacky outfits. It walks you through that. It's also a love story. It's also a comedy. And it's also incredibly ironic, since Debbie Reynolds is not the one who sings.
Yeah, she's dubbed over. And the whole plot, for people that don't know, Singing in the Rain is in the advent of talkies. A lot of actors and actresses were not able to make that transition because they didn't have the voice for the movies. And so the whole point is, let's get some people to dub over those people. And that's the case in Singing in the Rain, where Debbie Reynolds is voicing over what's that actress's name? She's so great, and all the controversy that comes from that. And in between there, you got a love story and all of that stuff.
Jean Hagen.
Yes. She's great. I really like her a lot. She is one of those people that you just love that she's able to play that dumb role so well.
Definitely one of the most memorable villains.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Lena Lamont.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I wonder, Rodrigo, have you seen the remake of Singing in the Rain?
There's a remake of Singing in the Rain?
There is a remake of Singing in the Rain. It's a movie that just came out like within the last 2 years. It stars Margot Robbie. It also has Diego Calva. Brad Pitt is in it. A whole bunch of other. Tobey Maguire is in this as well. And it is literally a... not shot for shot. It is literally a 2020s remake of Singing in the Rain.
Does it have like modern songs?
Oh yes. No, it doesn't even have songs. So it is literally the same story that is Singing in the Rain, the decadent, crazy, silent era of Hollywood. And then as the talkies are starting to come in, how everybody's lives fall apart. And the stories that they tell of the two male leads and the Margot Robbie lead, and how their lives slowly fall apart, is at one point, literally while I'm watching this movie, I'm like, you know, this is like the plot of Singing in the Rain. And then in the very last act, years later, when the Diego, his character, is much older and he's had to run away and flee to Mexico because of some things that he did, he comes back and he sees that there's a movie playing called Singing in the Rain. And he goes in and he watches it and he's like, oh my God, this is our story. I can't believe they've taken our story and turned it into Singing in the Rain. So there's both a remake and a meta on top of a meta commentary that goes on in Babylon. I will say this for people. There is a lot of sex, drugs, and there's like, if you want to see an elephant take a dump on a guy, that happens in the first 10 minutes of the movie, maybe even sooner in the movie. If you want to see people just going crazy with drugs, they bring in they don't name names. That's the interesting thing about this. But Fatty Arbuckle, during a wild party in the 1920s, 30s, got a girl drunk, and he supposedly, as the story goes, tried to rape her. And because he was so heavy, he crushed her to death because he was so big. There is a little bit in the first act that is all about that as well. So it is an interesting movie to watch. It is the polar opposite, because of Singing in the Rain is bright and happy and people dancing. Babylon, which is technically it's a remake or a retelling of the same story that you find in Singing in the Rain. It is dark and moody. It is like the 1960s Batman meets compared to Frank Miller's Batman.
Wow.
Even though it's the same story. So if you're up for it, if you can handle the level of sex and drug abuse that is in this movie, and Tobey Maguire plays a creep, serious creep. If you can handle that, I would encourage people to go check it out. I enjoyed it. It doesn't have a very high rating. It's like 57 on the Rotten Tomatoes meter, 7 out of 10 on the IMDb. But for a piece of film story about Hollywood that it is, it is super fantastic from just that standpoint. Yes, it's going to turn a lot of people off, but I found it fascinating. So there you go. So while we've already talked about my number two is The Seven Samurai, I want to take a moment before we get into our number one and talk about this show and talk about how you, dear listener, can keep this show alive and well and going far into the future, maybe even bringing John back in as a regular on this show. And we can do that with support from fine listeners just like you. I know it sounds like it's that time of the year where everybody is asking you to come over and help support our shows. But really, a lot of podcasters rely on our listeners to continue our shows. And so right now we're asking you, dear listener, if you enjoy the show and you would like to see it continue through 2024 and beyond, then we're asking you right now to take a moment and head over to patreon.com/majorspoilers. Check out what we have to offer as far as extras. We got bonus shows that come out each month, depending on what level you're at, anywhere from 4 to 10 different shows that come out each month for your listening pleasure, all exclusive to our Patreon. We have exclusive art, t-shirts, and a whole lot more depending on your funding level. And if you want to just kick us $2 a month, kick in $2 a month. If you want to do $5 a month, $5 a month is great. That's really what we're asking. If you find value in top five, if you're like, oh, I've never heard this movie, Seven Samurai. What is it about? Samurai again? And how many of them are there? If you've never heard about that and you're like, thank you, top five, for introducing me to the Seven Samurai, then by all means, $5 a month. You can even pay a year in advance. So you don't have to worry about the month to month. You can just say, you know what? Here's $60 for a full year. In fact, it's not even $60. If you do a full year, you get a little bit of a discount. So you're actually saving money when you pay once and the entire year is covered. Come on, help us out during this time. Help yourself out by becoming a patron today, a patron of the fine arts, the fine art of podcasting at patreon.com/majorspoilers. All right, Rodrigo, we have reached our number ones. And now I'm very curious what you have.
Okay. My number one is the second Japanese movie on the list. And the third movie from 1954. So 54, good year for me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also the second movie that has Takashi Shimura, but I'm sure he was in lots of stuff back then. I'm talking about Godzilla.
Oh, yeah.
1954.
So not only is this the second time for your actor to appear on the list, this is the second time for one of my actors to appear on the list in the form of Raymond Burr.
Oh, yeah. Who is in it in,
in the American weird version. In the American version, in a weird way.
Yeah. I mean, it's history, right?
Yeah.
First kaiju movie, also a time when people were like, well, people aren't going to get this weird kaiju movie, so let's put Raymond Burr in it.
Yeah, and he came in for like a day after the movie was out and released before they came here, and all he's doing is describing all the action on the scene. Like, he's this reporter, yeah, and he has to describe Godzilla smashing his way through Tokyo.
Yeah. So, if you've seen Godzilla Minus One, right? Godzilla Minus One is a retelling of the original Godzilla.
Mm-hmm.
It's really good. It's really fun. It kind of recontextualizes some stuff. But the number one thing that it does for me, did for me when I watched it, was it uses the original theme from Godzilla, which is a fantastic piece of music. It's like do 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 do. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
It's tense. It's orchestral. It sounds huge. It really fits Godzilla. There's a sort of whimsy to Godzilla that was probably not planned to be there, but it is like a big guy in a suit, so there's like a bouncy rubberiness to it.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And I think that soundtrack matches that. Again, I don't think it's intentional, but I think it's something that's there. Godzilla, of course, largely regarded as a sort of deconstruction of what was going on in Japan at the time as they were dealing with the literal and metaphorical fallout of the atom bomb.
Mm-hmm.
You see it in people. I think this is, I think when Godzilla made it to the West, people were not like Americans and Europeans were just didn't understand it. They didn't know what they were seeing. And you can see that to this day in the Godzilla adaptations, where Godzilla doesn't have that heft or that like huge emotional like power. For me, it took watching Godzilla Minus One, which like sort of, because it's a modern movie, contextualizes it differently, for me to really get is like, oh, like what we're doing to Godzilla now is offensive.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Like Godzilla is so much cooler than the movies that he's in the US. I've actually never seen Shin Godzilla, but I really need to go back and watch.
You really
that.
Should. That I have seen, yeah. Shin Godzilla, and I've enjoyed it a lot. I have not yet at this moment watched Godzilla Minus Zero because it's currently not available on the streaming services or through digital purchase. And I still continue to have my hatred for all things AMC. So, yeah, I don't go to the movies anymore.
Totally.
Yeah. Yeah. Here's the thing, though. I bet we could do a bonus episode as soon as Godzilla Minus One comes out. Maybe we can do a bonus episode, sure, where we do a commentary like we did in the old days. Maybe we can do that with the support, sure, from our friends over at patreon.com/majorspoilers. Just saying, something to look forward to.
Mm-hmm.
So you really like Godzilla Minus One?
I really did. It's very good.
All right. And you love the original Godzilla?
Yes.
Very good. Very good. It's interesting because my number one also has a creature that is destroying everything in its path. And it's, you know, we get to the point at some point, I always wonder when, because I was traumatized by a lot of scary movies when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. It just was like, oh, you shouldn't have watched this. You shouldn't have gone and seen that space vampire movie when you were 12. That's probably not a good thing for you to see. I worry about that with my kids because I'm like, oh, should I show them Alien? Is that too much for them? Of course, the youngest doesn't want to watch any of the scary movies, but the oldest, I said, oh, Alien is kind of a scary movie. And then he laughed all the way through it because he thought it was so funny about how the creature, you know, jumps out and grabs people and stuff. I'm like, that's a jump scare, dude. He's like, ah, that's so funny. He was upstairs talking to his mom. I was like, and then it came out. It was like, blah. And he, anyway, I was probably 3 years old when I saw this movie for the first time on television, and it freaked me the heck out. Even though it's the silliest premise, right? In the 1950s, especially 1958, we're trying to, you know, bring back good old America, whatever good old America is. And what's better than good old America than a warning about teenagers kissing in cars and doing things that they shouldn't be? And what a person in 1958 is, who is better to play a teenager than Steve McQueen?
Right.
Or as he was back then, Stephen McQueen.
Who at that point is already 30.
I know. He's like, the long history of old people playing teenagers continues in 1958's The Blob. Just this weird thing comes crashing to Earth and it starts to devour everything, a giant amoeba. And it devours an old man in the woods. It devours a car. It devours half the town until they finally figure out that if we freeze it, then we can pick it up and just drop it in the Antarctic. Because, yeah. What better thing to do than to just drop it somewhere that will not cause us any trouble ever again, global warming. So The Blob is really weird because it is this kind of American ingenuity and good kids will solve the problem as opposed to the bad kids that are making out in cars and they're going to be killed. And this threat of some existential thing, whatever that may be, it could be a thing from outer space. It could be communism that is going to come in and devour us quietly from the inside, and then wrap it up in this horror movie where you have to run, don't walk from the blob. I know today people look at the 58 version and they just laugh at it. And then they take the 70s version a little bit more seriously. And I want to say there was one more after that that was made. But the 58 version, as a 3-year-old watching that, it creeped me the heck out. And I've loved it ever since. I've loved it ever since. So The Blob is my number one movie from the 1950s. So there you go, ladies and gentlemen. What'd you think? What movies did we miss? There were a lot. You were right, Rodrigo. The 1950s were a time probably, I don't know if it's the greatest decade for movies, but certainly when we talk about
great movies. Definitely an explosion for movies.
Yeah. I mean, we didn't
a lot of good movies. Yeah.
Nothing on this list is a big spectacle, right? Like Ben-Hur came out in the 1950s.
Right.
The Robe. I forget what year the Ten Commandments came out.
I think it was in the 50s.
Yeah, I think that was also just the big, 1956. Just the big biblical epics that came out in the 1950s. It was just crazy time to see all of this stuff. I don't think today you could have as many major movies that came out in the 1950s. I don't think you could do that today. And I know we look at movies like Avengers and Titanic and all these movies with $200+ million budgets. It's not just spectacle. It is just things that drove audiences to theaters. And I don't think we're doing that right now. So what do you think, ladies and gentlemen? What did we miss on our list? Here's what you can do. You can head over to the Major Spoilers Discord server. You can join that Discord server absolutely free. There is a channel called Top 5, and you can jump into that Top 5 channel, and you can share your Top 5 list, your Top 5 movies from the 1950s. Other people will share their Top 5 movies from the 1950s. People will have discussions about their movies from the 1950s. Why? Because everyone loves a list. And we will talk with you again soon.
This podcast is copyright 2024 by Major Spoilers Entertainment, LLC.